Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Popular Music podcast. In this episode, I speak with Aisha Durham, the author of Home with Hip Hop Feminism. Our conversation examines how ordinary women engage with hip hop. We also discuss how hip hop creates sexual scripts for African American women. Along the way, we talk about a number of musicians, including Queen Latifah, Nicki Minaj, Beyonce, and Erykah Badu. Well, welcome to the podcast, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you decided to write Home with Hip Hop Feminism?
Hi, well, I'm Aisha Durham, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Communication at the University of South Florida. And much of my research intersects three areas: media studies or media and culture, women's studies or gender and women's studies, and Africana studies. So in some ways, my work is always centered around the intersections of how we think and talk about Black women in popular culture. Well, I can say that I wanted to start off as an MC, but I don't think that I had the rhythm to be able to do that quite well. But like most female MCs, I came to write autoethnography, and I came to write kind of life fictions in some way through poetry. Poetry was my entree into writing about my own lived experience, and I think in some ways hip-hop and rap in general, it kind of takes up that lived reality or a particular kind of perspective from working class youth. And so that was my way of starting to write when I was young. And when I found out, wow, you could actually study hip hop in school, my graduate research was talking about hip hop in general, thinking about the aesthetics, taking cues from people like Trisha Rose and Joe Morgan. And by the time that I was doing my dissertation research, I wanted to talk about hip hop and women in hip hop, but not necessarily talking about women as practitioners. I think a lot of the research was about women as whether they were the visual imagery or even talking about the lyrics of women. But I want to talk about the ordinary, everyday ways in which we engage with hip-hop, not just as a culture, but also as a kind of generational construct. So some people may pick up my book and think that, you know, well, you know, where are all the discussions about Nicki Minaj? But I'm most interested in the ways in which everyday people who make up the culture live the culture, and that's what I think my contribution is, and that's what I hope to kind of contribute to hip hop studies, but also thinking about the different areas, whether it's autoethnography or cultural criticism, even talking about performance.
So what are some of the challenges in approaching music from the lens of everyday people? How do you get at that? How do you build evidence for everyday musical practices?
Well, I think one of the things I went into the project thinking that I was going to get some kind of some kind of essential way of thinking about hip hop culture by going to working class women who make up the culture. And really, when I was trying to get them to think about hip hop, they really kept telling me things about ordinary everyday life that had nothing to do with music. And for me, I thought, well, this project is not going well. I am supposed to be talking about the aesthetics, the lyricism in particular songs, or even talking about icons. And they were talking about, I don't know, working or motherhood. And these were the topics that were central to them. And so I guess as a music critic, but also an ethnographer, one of the things that you have to do as a researcher is to be open to the possibilities of new ways and new routes of thinking about culture. And one of the ways, and I go back to kind of early ethnographic scholarship, even ethnographic scholarship in hip hop, was thinking about the ways in which we use culture and the ways in which we make culture. And in that sense, I then had to go back and not to say, well, you know, this particular audience didn't know what I was talking about because they did not know hip hop feminism. But then I had to think about, no, well, what are they saying hip hop is? And from all accounts, from the people that I talked to, not only in this particular community, but across the country as I speak, it's the sentiment is the same. Hip hop is everyday life. Hip hop is life. So if we want to think about how to talk about hip hop, then we have to talk about the everyday lives. And in this case, the everyday lives of women of color.
Well, one of the things that I think is fascinating is that so much hip hop scholarship is interested in notions of space. And frequently it's very public, it's outside, it's public space. And I love how you turned this notion of space to home. And so I would love to hear more about your concept of how space works in hip hop and maybe within hip hop feminism.
So there are two things that are happening in terms of talking about space. So I'm not necessarily discounting space in terms of how the public cultivates a particular space, because and this goes back to Murray Forman and the like, because it is uniquely Southern, and even the way in which the conversations were taking place. There were stories before we got to the information. There was sit down and talk to us. So there are all these ways that made it uniquely Southern. So that's a particular way in which a particular aesthetic in terms of Southern hip hop. But Kira Gaunt also talks about this in terms of there are these private spaces, these intimate spaces, these homosocial kind of communities where you have Black girls and Black women who gather, who have completely different conversations than those that are usually on the street corner or in the club or even on the radio. And so in that space of the living room, or even in the space of home, where I'm I mean, I literally did the focus groups inside of a public housing community's living room. Again, they were talking about child rearing. They were talking about, you know, their own bodies and being vulnerable. So these are not necessarily topics or themes that we hear, even if we were to listen to women on the radio in terms of rap music. So I think that space is important not only in terms of thinking about the particular aesthetics of a Southern kind of hip hop, but it's also important in the kinds of conversations that that might take place.
And so, and again, this is another thing that I thought was just so fascinating, was that hip hop so frequently gets mapped sort of East Coast, West Coast, and then you've got sort of Third Coast, and then I didn't even kind of even know where to put sort of your subjects, you know, because, you know, it was like, was it more Northern? Was it more Southern? Was it East Coast? Was it West Coast? How do I feel? So what was it like to do research in the place that you did, and how did they position themselves within hip hop if they did?
Well, I don't know if they necessarily position themselves within hip hop. I mean, I know that at least two did. One of the respondents that I talked to came from New York, and she was very vocal about telling us that she was from New York, you know, and coming to the South. But I know even for me growing up, Virginia is a unique space, especially in terms of the kind of Tidewater area. And one, because it's surrounded by historically Black colleges and universities. And so there was always a kind of very diversity of music taking place, whether we listened to DC go-go or Northeast hip hop, or the emerging at that time, but it was not clearly identified Southern hip hop. But this also came about through our own, you know, transportation system through the I-95 corridor. So we will also get music through that way. So there is a north, there is a northeast, growing up, there was a northeast kind of background in terms of hip hop. And it was only until we had people like Timbaland or Missy Elliott or Pharrell to make a particular kind of mark. And later we see with the Clips and the latter that we have a kind of a bona fide identity in terms of Mid-Atlantic or even Virginia for that matter. So I don't know. It wouldn't be Virginia wouldn't be marked as particularly Dirty South like we would talk about in terms of outcasts and the like, but it's still Southern. And I think because of the position of Virginia and kind of the Mid-Atlantic, we take parts of both. And you can see that reflected in some of the hip hop artists. But I think that the women themselves identify, I mean, other than the New Yorker, and if you're from New York, you're never going to say you're from anywhere else, identify as Southern. But they don't say it with the pronouncement of Southern, but the particular ways of talking, of telling stories, of either or even gathering in a particular space. These are all very kind of marked Southern ways of belonging and performing Black womanhood.
So let's try to dive in a little bit further into how the relationship or between sort of hip hop and gender and hip hop and social class. And what were some of the things that you were sort of learning as you were going about your study?
Well, one of the things that I mean, there's, you know, two decades of scholarship that talks about hip hop in terms of gender relations, whether it's talking about sexism in hip hop or thinking about homophobia in hip hop or misogyny. So we have a robust archive of research that talks about that. And much of my work also talks about sexual scripts and kind of gender misrepresentation in hip hop culture. One of the things that I wanted to actually trouble was class, because class becomes a way in which we actually mark and unmark hip hop in ways that speak to gender expression, but also racial authenticity. So, for example, hip hop is marked as a working class cultural product, even if people who perform it and later are not part of that kind of socioeconomic class. So there's a particular kind of class consciousness that comes with it. But there's also a way in which it marks a particular kind of racial authenticity. So working class blackness becomes a way to say that I am Black. And it is one of the ways in which you see in contemporary culture where even suburban Blacks or even non-Black participants or consumers use this kind of working class Black sensibility in order to write themselves within Black popular culture or Black hip hop culture. And then in terms of gender, it also becomes a way of marking femininity, right? Because in some ways, working class Black womanhood is always already marked as out of control, being a loose woman. And even if we use terms today like being ratchet, so that's a contemporary kind of term. These terms are all associated, or even the use of the word ghetto, which is one that I trouble in the book. These are terms that are connected to supposedly behavior, but they're behavior connected to a class identity. And so it becomes a way of policing not only race, but it also is a way of policing gender expression and sexuality. And so I try to work through that. And one of the ways I do that is through my own life, coming from public housing and having to kind of combat some of the very stereotypes about working class womanhood, whether it's the welfare queen, the neglectful mother, all of those particular stereotypes, and then moving out of public housing to go away to college, which is supposed to afford me kind of educational cultural capital, and then moving into the middle class where, you know, I'm around people who did not come from this particular economic background, and they have ways of talking about Black women, working class Black women, that are not markedly different from the ways in which I heard in terms of larger white populations or the dominant media. And this was troubling to me. And they would tell me over and over again, I'm not talking about a specific person. When I say ghetto, I really mean like a behavior. But it is connected to a person. Somebody has to be doing it. So that idea of what class does, so class does the work of racializing and class does the work of gendering particular bodies when we don't want to necessarily use race.
So I was really interested in how you were talking about social class there. And I found myself almost getting stuck in my sort of graduate school days because, mm-hmm. You know, working class to me, it seems like it's already marked so racially frequently. And so I was probably kind of spinning a little bit in my head. I was like, well, how do people identify as working class in America? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily signify a racial identity or not, or an ethnic identity. And I don't know if I even have a good question here, but I found myself really thinking about just the difficulties of even just talking about social class mm-hmm. in America, as you were talking about that. So, maybe at the risk of asking too broad of a question, how much self-consciousness is there within hip hop about class lines and class divisions?
Well, first, I would say that in the United States, everybody is supposed to be middle class,
right.
Which is completely not true. But that's the logic of capitalism that we have told ourselves. So when I say working class, I can take that more broadly to be laboring classes. But I think it's very conscious. I don't think that the actual language is used in terms of working class. But the idea of quote unquote, the idea of the hood itself is supposed to be a class marker. It's supposed to be a class marker and it's supposed to be a racial marker, in some cases as well. So I think in that way, hip hop is very reflective. It's one of the ways of becoming. It's one of the ways of kind of having a particular entree, into hip hop culture. And if you're not from a kind of working class neighborhood, then your credentials as an MC itself could be called into question. And it's only when we have, later MCs or even the popularization of hip hop that goes beyond kind of streets or hoods that we have a different kind of acceptance of people who may not be from particular socioeconomic class. But one of the things that is different in this moment, I mean, we could talk about pre-1970s where it didn't matter what class you were in because of housing discrimination, you probably lived in the same neighborhood. But one of the things that we see in this moment is that not just in general, I mean, not just with African-Americans in terms of class connected to production, but class connected to consumption. So class, even if you're from, and I'm from a Norfolk public housing community called Dickstown, which was Dick's Park. It was, you know, renamed Dickstown as if it was supposed to mean something different. But it's through consumption. And so even as I have this particular class background, I am still supposed to perform as if I'm middle class or even rich for that matter. And that comes through, quote unquote, bling, right? That comes through all of the branding. And so that is a way to kind of showcase that, you know, I might be from here, but look at me. I am like you. So I think there is a lot of discussion about class within hip hop, even if it's not marked in the same ways in which we talk about class today.
I'm going to kind of shift back to the idea of sexual scripts, because that's mm-hmm. a major part of your book. And I really was very interested in your section about Queen Latifah and mm-hmm. And sort of the scripts that she adapted, was forced to use. How do you see Queen Latifah and how her image changed over time in hip hop? What do you have to say about her?
Well, one of the first things is that I think with the increased visibility of hip hop, the visual representation and the participation of women in hip hop, the roles that women play, shifted dramatically. It's not as if women, you know, pre-MTV or BET were not seen as sexual objects or even terms that were used. We just use different terms, you know. Thought today, it was the skeezer then. So it's not as if those things did not exist. However, there was more diversity. There were more visual representation, and there was more participation in hip hop in general. But there was a kind of diverse or a range of voices that one could have if one participated in hip hop. And that's not necessarily today. And I think for Queen Latifah represented the idea that you could be an MC, also that you could, you know, be Afrocentric. And I think that was growing up, that was pivotal in terms of her own visual representation, that she looked like just someone that you saw in the neighborhood. That was important because it also let you know that you could be like her, right? So there was the kind of unattainable beauty standards in which we see in all of popular culture, but also in terms of hip hop, it troubles me to some extent today. So when Queen Latifah came out, those were, whether it's in terms of her Afrocentricity, as well as her lyricism, but her business savvy, having her own company and the like, and being a part of a larger kind of crew of other MCs taken seriously as a female MC. That was very moving. But as we see her move into Hollywood and acting, it's interesting to me that the two films at that time in which she received the most acclaim were the two films in which she basically took on these very kind of archaic sexual scripts, whether that's in terms of the mammy, and I say that in terms of the Maitre Mama Morton in Chicago, or in terms of the hood rat or the hoochie, and we see that in Bringing Down the House. And I mean, we could look at her different roles, and other people have talked about her and Set It Off, which I actually think is a very progressive representation. But these two got the most in terms of blockbuster kind of success. And so it makes me ask, like, how do we have a voice within mainstream Hollywood if these are the roles that, you know, that we occupy? And so in some ways, hip hop was this alternative space by which we could craft our own identities. But as soon as you become too popular, then that representation becomes somewhat limited. And we can see this with other MCs, such as Nicki Minaj. I mean, when she first came out, even on mixtapes, no matter, you know, what the language that she uses or the personas that she takes on, I mean, nobody can deny, you know, that she is just a great lyricist. She became more popular, the visual representation became very constrained. And she works within those constraints. but it still recalls some of the same sexual strips, scripts that basically suggest that Black women are sexually available and accessible.
And so, and this may be moving a little bit away from what you're writing about in the book, but there's this idea of what it takes to be crossover and sort of crossing over from maybe a genre to being pop. And are there sort of maybe different rules in pop than there are in hip hop, or different scripts? Or how do you see that process when someone tries to cross over?
Well, I would say that hip hop is pop. So I would say that it's probably the most recognized genre, you know, coming out of America, period. So it is popular culture. It's defined American popular culture for the past 20 years. So I would say, if we're talking about popular hip hop, because I think there are a number of women who are not a part of that kind of popular hip hop, who remind me of the Queen Latifahs. Akur Naru, for example, I absolutely love her, but Akur Naru is not Nicki Minaj, and I don't think Akur Naru wants to be Nicki Minaj. But there's a way in which, again, but this is not just endemic of female artists in hip hop, but this is just a female artist in general, that there are particular ways in which women are invited, and that's in quotes, invited to perform their sexuality. And for women of color, especially women of African descent, it is connected to this kind of visceral way of thinking about the fleshiness of our bodies and connect it to the butt. And I have whole sections of talking about what that means in terms of being an asset for kind of cultural capital in general.
Well, so that kind of leads us right into sort of your section on Beyonce, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you really, it seems like you're focusing particularly in sort of when Beyonce is kind of playing around with the character Sasha Fierce. So what was going on there, and how does Beyonce manage and use these scripts?
Yeah, so I think that Beyonce and Queen Latifah are doing similar things. But I think what happens with when we see Beyonce, I think she has a particular class privilege that enables her to kind of move back and forth. So she can be Sasha Fierce. She can, you know, talk about, you know, being ratchet on the one hand, and then she can come out in a ball gown on the other hand and be taken as hip hop royalty with Jay-Z. So there's a way in which she can do that. And I don't think women who are already marked as kind of, and I'm saying class because I'm seeing it in terms of hip hop working class, cannot. I don't think Lil' Kim could have ever made that transition or even say that this is my persona, but this is who I really am. She can't do that. And I also see that it's something that Nicki Minaj is even trying to do, even as she creates more personas or saying, no, this is me. And she's supposed to have a show coming out about her life, saying this is my hip hop persona, but this is me. But I think because she's marked in a particular way in terms of class, that she doesn't have that that malleability or that mobility that Beyonce does. But I think Beyonce knows those, she knows very well those scripts, whether it's in terms of a particular way of thinking about class or even thinking about gender and sexuality. And she can mine Black girl culture, she can mine hip hop culture, but at the same time, she sees herself and people see her as a lady. And a lady has a very particular class connotation. And as a lady, she can say, well, this is me. I'm just performing this identity. Everybody is, but we see somehow that is not Beyonce. But when we look at Nicki Minaj, we say, no, that is Nicki Minaj.
So you didn't, again, you didn't address this in the book, but as you were talking about sort of class positions and what is available to Beyonce, I could not help jump to her hair. And so how does hair play into these dynamics that you're talking about?
Well, I think there's a really faint mention of it, but I know in previous work, I've actually analyzed a music video where she actually does play with hair. In one video, she has cornrows, for example, and the cornrows are supposed to represent, again, her kind of street authenticity, right? Her street status. And even in the in another video, she kind of pats her head, and that's kind of connected to kind of when you want to get a perm or you want to get your hair done and your hair is itching, which you can't. So there are these kind of signifiers that Beyonce uses that is so a part of Black girl culture, and there are ways in which she stylizes herself that are particularly connected to class. But as I stated before, she has a malleability of moving, you know, in and out of that. And she can do that with costuming, whether it's in terms of her hair or whether that's in terms of her outfit or, itself. She is definitely aware of the different kinds of class politics that are in play, and those class politics that are, again, connected to sexuality.
And so I kind of want to use that as kind of a way to shift maybe to the last section of the book, which as somebody who studies pop music and struggles with the study of pop music, I found that this last section to be really powerful because, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, I want to kind of give you the space to kind of talk about what you experienced, but I thought it was very powerful that you acknowledge that when you went back into Digstown, that you were a changed person and you weren't quite the person you were when you lived there. And you were going back maybe as an outsider or partially an outsider. Can you maybe talk about that? How, as researchers maybe, and people who study music, we maybe become maybe outsiders to the thing that we used to be insiders in. Does that make any sense?
Yes, absolutely. I started writing about hip hop because I was a fan, and I am a fan of hip hop, and I believe myself to have some insider knowledge that other people didn't have. Surely my professors didn't know anything about it. So I had some kind of insider status. And I also felt that way in terms of the community that I was going home to. I mean, I say I'm going home. But in that moment of going home, not only did I realize how much of an outsider I was to the culture that I was writing about, but also to the community for which I'm suggesting that I represent. And that was a humbling moment for me, but it was also a moment of, again, possibility. And I think that that becomes a way of me even wrestling with my own class position. Because a part of the book, while it is broken up in terms of autoethnography and textual analysis or cultural criticism and kind of focus groups or ethnography, it really is an autoethnographic account of my encounter with my own memories, my encounter with the images that I see, and an encounter with the women with whom I meet. So when I go to that space, I have to say that I am not, and I'm not in Digstown. I am from Digstown, but I cannot represent this community in the same way because I don't live here. I don't have. When they tell me their daily lives, my life is not. It is not the same as theirs. And I have to acknowledge, so even as I'm talking about Black women, that there are class differences, and these class differences are meaningful. And so when we talk about hip hop, that we have to be attuned to not only differences in terms of thinking about gender, but also sexuality and class. We have to make those markers. And throughout our conversation, even, we've been talking about hip hop in a kind of broad kind of sense. But there are multiple ways in which the women wanted to engage with hip hop, not only in talking about it in terms of culture. They wanted to talk about it in terms of lived reality, but they also wanted to talk about it in a very gender sense, a gendered sense, which we don't talk about as being a part of hip hop. We don't talk about the role in terms of motherhood. We don't talk about sexual abuse. We don't talk about the kind of economic struggles in terms of Black mothers. I mean, there are songs and there are odes to mothers. But we don't have a kind of sophisticated way of thinking about what does it mean when we actually say that, you know, the mantra is I am hip hop. What does that mean when we say I am hip hop? Or what does it mean when we say hip hop is life?
Yeah, so I also like to hear you say a little bit about what do you think are some of the next steps that need to happen in scholarship now that someone like yourself and other folks are starting to kind of wrestle with this insider-outsider status in hip-hop and in pop music in general. Where should scholars be going? How should this be affecting what we do?
Yeah, I think in some ways what has happened to scholarship, which I find very invigorating, is that we've gone back to some of the earliest forms of scholarship and cultural studies in hip hop. We've gone back to using ethnography. I think in some ways, some of the early work in terms of hip hop was really trying to map the aesthetics and see again, what does hip hop, if we're talking about hip hop culture, what does it look like? Who are the people who participate in it? And this helped to form the kind of the groundwork or lay the groundwork for what we would call hip hop studies or music studies in terms of hip hop. And then we moved toward much of the discussion is in terms of visual culture and text-based analysis. And I think some of the most nuanced ways of thinking about hip hop today is not necessarily by looking at the music, by looking at the people who produce and make a part of that kind of music community. So looking at hip hop communities, I think, or communities who are part of what we would call the hip hop generation or the post hip hop generation. And from that, you get, you know, work by people like Ruth Nicole Brown or Bettina Love, who are looking at, Black girls and girls of color in education and schools and thinking about how do they engage with it. You get work by Adriana Clay, who's looking at hip hop in terms of social justice and activism. So I think future steps would be, you know, look actually going to the people and seeing what it looks like, because I think that can give us a clue of where we're going from here.
Well, thank you for taking so much time and speaking with me today. But before we go, are there any projects you're working on?
Yes. So speaking of where are we going from here, one of the projects that I'm working on currently is talking about Afrofuturism. And I am looking at Afrofuturism through the lens of what Erykah Badu. And I'm looking at Erykah Badu as a kind of not only in terms of her iconicity, but as a way of seeing how she is firmly rooted in Southern culture. But there's a way in which her work, whether it's the actual technologies that she employs or even the kind of discourses that she engages in, is always this kind of forward thinking. So she works between, you know, reimagining or imagining new ways of belonging while still being anchored in this very kind of this historical past of kind of African centered culture. So I think that her work, and people love Kendrick Lamar right now, but I think her work actually lays the groundwork. So people like, you know, even Outkast for that matter, or Kendrick Lamar could be possible. So I'm looking at her work in order to talk about the ways in which African Americans have always had to live in this, you know, reimagining belonging in a space where we are actually seen in some ways as not ever really belonging. So imagining that planet rock. And so that's the piece that I'm working on, Afrofuturism and Baduism.
Well, this is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the New Books in Popular Music podcast. Today I've been talking with Aisha Durham, the author of Home with Hip Hop Feminism. This is your host, Richard Scherr. Thank you for listening.